You are listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Our subject today is symptoms and signs of Cushing's syndrome. This podcast is made possible in part by a generous contribution from Corcept Therapeutics. Here's Dr. Lewis Blevins.
Good afternoon, folks. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News podcasting to you today from the coast of Northern California. The topic for today's conversation is the symptoms and signs of Cushing syndrome. This is prompted by a recent patient experience of a young lady who had a macroadenoma of the pituitary gland that was invading the skull base and resulting in ACTH hypersecretion with hypersecretion of cortisol, but she had very minimal Cushingoid features. Certainly she was overweight and had a little central weight redistribution, but not much else. And had I seen her in the mall or out at a restaurant or something like that, I would not have thought of her as having Cushing's syndrome or disease. So it brings to mind the fact that some patients with the disorder do not have the classic clinical and physical features, and I wanted to spend some time with you folks on that matter. So it's no surprise then that there is a wide spectrum of clinical presentation of patients with hypercortisolism. And I, after over a quarter of a century of dealing with patients with the disorder, have my own, if you will, theories about why this might be the case. So I'll talk about some of those first. Firstly, many patients have different durations of disease process. Some patients have had the disease for 5 years, others two, some 15 or 20. And the duration of exposure to high cortisol levels does have a lot to do with how hypercortisolemic or how Cushingoid a patient will appear to be. Also, we know that some patients make ACTH very efficiently, and that packs a great punch, and small tumors can release large amounts of ACTH and cause very high cortisol levels, whereas tumors that are more efficient may not be associated with very high levels of cortisol production. I believe that some patients have differing tissue sensitivities to cortisol and thus have, in some cases, very mild to no symptoms, in other cases, very severe, even though hormone levels are the same. So you could take two patients with hypercortisolism, same urine cortisol elevations, and you'd see two entirely different diseases because of those different tissue sensitivities coupled with the duration of the disease and the time of exposure to cortisol. I also believe that the underlying causes play a role in determining the clinical manifestations of the disorder. Classically, we're told that those patients with ectopic ACTH have more aggressive disease, shorter duration, more likely to have hypokalemia, and severe profound myopathy, for example. And those patients with pituitary disease have the classic Cushingoid history and physical appearance. However, we see patients with ectopic ACTH who look like pituitary disease and vice versa. So while those rules do hold most of the time, they're not hard and fast. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that there are other genetic factors that can modulate the response to cortisol levels. So, for example, patients who have the genes for metabolic syndrome, or what was used to be referred to as syndrome X, are those who are more likely to get profound Cushingoid features, including hypertension, diabetes mellitus, elevated lipid levels, etc. Some patients present largely with depression because of the effects that cortisol has on their brain. So, in my opinion, that's more likely to happen in patients who have an underlying history of depression. And the bottom line is that if you have a genetic tendency to have other underlying diseases, those can be brought out much sooner if you have hypercortisolism, and it can modulate how the patient presents with hypercortisolism and contributes to this wide variation in the clinical expression of the disease that we see as endocrinologists. Now, another example of an underlying situation or condition that can modulate the disease process is expressed in a couple of patients that I have seen. One of them had an enzyme deficiency in her gastrointestinal tract that caused malabsorption and maldigestion. And though she had marked hypercortisolism, she did not look Cushingoid, but instead had a marked proximal myopathy. Another patient was a triathlon and was burning 8,000 calories a day, and clearly that patient had minimal Cushingoid features and also presented with a myopathy. So in summary, what we have here is a disease process that can be mild, moderate, or severe in regards to symptomatology and cortisol levels and ACTH levels, can be of variable duration due to different underlying causes, resulting in different clinical manifestations in different patients. And while there are textbook cases that we see of patients with hypercortisolism, there are plenty of patients who do not have the classic presentation and as a result may have a longer pathway to discovery. This is made even more difficult by a couple of factors. The first one is the rarity of the disease process. The physicians aren't tuned into it. They're not expecting it. Most physicians have never seen a patient with endogenous Cushing syndrome. However, most physicians have seen patients who have excess steroids because they prescribe steroids for asthma, skin conditions, rheumatologic conditions, etc. And they're used to seeing Cushingoid patients who are Cushingoid due to treatment. But then when a patient shows up and doesn't have the steroids on their medicine list but looks Cushingoid, they fail to recognize, oh, this patient might have endogenous disease. So patients can go a long time without an underlying diagnosis. And I've seen that in many particular situations. So those are the two factors, the rarity of the disease and also the cognitive dissonance that takes place in the physician's office that can lead to delays in diagnosis. Now, this doesn't mean that doctors are stupid or ignorant or whatever term you want to use. Medicine is very difficult to practice, and this is a rare disease. And it's often not thought of because people haven't seen a case of endogenous Cushing's, and they usually would first think about steroid therapy, and maybe the patient had been given steroids by somebody else. So while the delay in diagnosis is often frustrating, as a physician who practices endocrinology, I've seen it a multitude of times, and I've actually seen patients develop Cushing's under the watch of an endocrinologist before, who took about 7 years to diagnose it after it was obvious based on the clinical presentation that the patient had had. So who do you suspect might actually have Cushing's? Well, obviously the syndrome is pretty readily apparent in many patients, and it is textbook and classic, and it fits the diagnosis or condition of a, quote, syndrome, unquote, for reasons. And that's central weight redistribution, weight gain, plethora, easy bruising, stria, and so on. Most of you are familiar with those symptoms and signs. But some of those things, including the hypertension, the hypokalemia, the proximal muscle weakness, etc., are common in other disease processes as well. And a number of physicians have tried to sort of figure out who do you really truly need to suspect the disorder in to be able to make the clinical diagnosis. And a number of years ago, there were a couple papers out looking at what's called discriminant function analysis. And they thought that the most reliable clinical features suggestive of hypercortisolism in patients who were ultimately proved to have the disease process were such as proximal myopathy, osteoporosis in a young person, especially a man, widened purplish stria, and definite thinning of the skin with ecchymoses. In my practice, I've also noted that patients sometimes have marked and rapid weight gain. I've often seen patients gain 50 to 100% of their body weight over a couple year period, and that's pretty consistent with hypercortisolism unless there's something else going on. Altered body composition, where you have central fat gain and loss of muscle mass in the periphery, weight redistribution, those things are fairly significant and highly suggestive as well. We always look for the cervicodorsal fat pad. Some people call it the buffalo hump, and also supraclavicular fat pad thickening. That seems to be two findings that go along well with the likelihood of having definite hypercortisolism. And then plethora, or the reddening of the entire face, rounding of the facies, hypertrichosis, which is a increase in the downy hair, not the terminal hairs that you can see on the face in people, particularly women. Some patients have hypertension, which is of complex etiology. Others have diabetes mellitus or glucose intolerance. And some patients have hyperlipidemia as well. So many of these features of Cushing sound like metabolic syndrome, and some women are thought to have polycystic ovary syndrome, and they can be confused with one another. And I think that probably is one of the main things that leads to the delay in diagnosis, especially in women, is that women are thought to have polycystic ovary syndrome because Cushing's and the hypercortisolism can lead to anovulation, and it looks just like polycystic ovary syndrome. And that's where the discriminant function analysis comes into play to try to increase the likelihood that patients are diagnosed sooner rather than later. Now, to make matters complex, a small proportion of patients with hypercortisolism probably do have periodic hormonogenesis resulting in cyclical Cushing's, and in these patients, the symptoms may sort of come and go. And the most striking case that I've seen is a patient who had marked hypercortisolism, marked Cushingoid features on examination, and then would suddenly miraculously recover, and over a period of 2 months would go back to her normal self, and then about 3 months later would have another episode, and then would recover and would have another episode. And that's typical. And interestingly, with cyclical Cushing's, it's also periodic, so that you could actually chart out, if you will, the symptoms and signs, and they would occur with a regularity. It's not an erratic occurrence of repeat symptoms and signs, but they occur with regularity. Most patients would have adrenal insufficiency or low normal cortisol levels in between spikes of cortisol production. Now, one of the other things I'll point out is that those patients who have had Cushing's and have been rendered disease-free or put into remission, who then have a recurrence, can be very instructive and help us understand some of the very mild, subtle features of Cushing's. And these are patients who had hypercortisolism and then experienced normality and then had recurrent hypercortisolism. And almost always, the things that patients who are in this situation tell me is that they first notice a problem with sleep, so disordered sleep-wake cycle, difficulty getting to sleep, feeling energized all the time, but also feeling tired. Many of them start to gain a little bit of weight, and the women usually will talk about some abnormal menses. So those seem to be the more common things seen in patients who are starting to have a recurrence after initial successful treatment. And to add to that, I can remember a couple patients who also noted that they were starting to have a depressed mood or starting to have memory loss as well. So those are things to keep in mind if you've had Cushing's and seem to be in remission, things to keep in mind that might indicate you could potentially be having. Now, earlier I alluded to the fact that the disease presentation can be modified based on the underlying disease process, and I talked about Cushing's disease due to pituitary tumor having the classic presentation. Ectopic ACTH often having a severe presentation with proximal myopathy and hypokalemia, and the Cushing's disease due to macroadenomas of the pituitary, you might have mild, moderate, or severe disease that can vary depending on all those other factors in the regards to the patient. The one that I didn't mention earlier is that of the adrenal adenoma, and this is a very interesting cause of Cushing syndrome, and it used to be thought that adrenal adenomas greater than 2 centimeter were the ones that were associated with hypercortisolism and Cushingoid features. But what we know is that a number of these tumors smaller than 2 centimeter do produce cortisol in an autonomous fashion against what we would call the grain of the normal diurnal variation, and that can result in symptoms and signs in patients who have, quote, normal, close quote, cortisol levels, but their cortisol is secreted erratically throughout the day and it's not normal for them. And that's one of the earlier features of Cushing's is loss of that diurnal variation. And some of these patients with adrenal adenomas do have that and have mild hypercortisolemic symptoms such as some mild weight gain or maybe some hypertension or glucose intolerance or sleep disturbances or memory problems. And this is an emerging area where we're seeing patients that we call subclinical Cushing's who have adrenal adenomas less than 2 centimeter that produce cortisol. Levels are normal, but clearly it's not pituitary-driven cortisol production. And many of these patients ultimately do need treatment or ultimately will need treatment in the future. a couple of ways to discern who might need treatment are to do a salivary cortisol profile to determine if there is the loss of the diurnal variation. Some people do an overnight 1 mg dexamethasone suppression test. Other people look at the ACTH, and if it's less than 15, would think about surgery. Now, one other potential way to approach this would be to treat patients with mifepristone to block the glucocorticoid receptor to see if some of those potentially mild and maybe related or not related symptoms or signs of hypercortisolism might improve with treatment. I haven't done that yet. It's theoretical, but it's something that might be useful to evaluate whether or not you take a patient to surgery versus, whether you take a patient to surgery versus simply following them and observing them over time. So that's one possibility for those patients, and in fact, may be a possibility for other patients with hypercortisolism as well. So at any rate, that's about all I have to say today. I wanted to ponder this topic for you. I hope this has been interesting and useful or informative. Please share it with your friends and family members, and especially your physicians and healthcare providers. And let's make the world a better, more informed place in regards to hypercortisolism. Once again, this is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. Thank you for listening, and feel free to drop us a line indicating your interest in future podcasts or share your questions with us. Thanks again, and have a good day.